We head to Washington, D.C., and Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter David Farenthold, and boy, has he been investigating. You have an extensive piece up on the New York Times website now about Elon Musk's charitable operations. Now, you wouldn't have been drawn to that unless you suspected something. So can you just give us the thumbnail sketch of what it is you're looking into?
Sure. The Musk Foundation is huge. It's got more than $5 billion, which puts it more in the top 20 of all foundations in the U.S. in terms of how much money it has. But what drew it to us is because it doesn't use that money like it's supposed to. For one thing, there's a minimum legal requirement for foundations to give away 5% of their money every year just to make sure they don't stockpile their money and sit on it forever. And he doesn't do that. In fact, at the end of 2022, which is the last data we have, he was $234 million behind, just $234 million below the legal minimum for giving his money away.
Mm-hmm.
And what we also found was that when he did give his money away, he often gave it to things that helped himself. So, for instance, he is a customer for SpaceX, his rocket company, that basically charters a rocket to fly him into space, this billionaire. And the billionaire, to sort of ennoble what he's doing, says, I'm going to raise $200 million with this flight for St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. But he doesn't. He goes up into space. He comes back down. For whatever reason, nobody wants to give to a billionaire's, midlife crisis. And he's short of his fundraising goal. So then Musk says, I'll kick in $50 million for the Musk Foundation to put you over the top. A few weeks later, the same guy charters three more rocket flights from SpaceX. So the Musk Foundation helps a good customer become a great customer at SpaceX. And another thing it did was, in two cases, to fund schools that, although they were supposed to be serving the public, really just serve Musk's own employees.
Are you being fair? Because he is giving money to charities, just not as much as he's supposed to.
Right. So that's important for people to understand. This is not a story where I said, I think Elon Musk should give money to charity, and I'm going to try to measure how much is he giving away as much as I think he should. The key thing is here, he did put this job on himself. He put this responsibility on himself because in 2021, he gives $5 billion worth of Tesla stock to his own foundation and gets a giant tax break, maybe as much as $2 billion off his taxes that year. So once you do that, once you get the benefit of that tax break, then you have a job to do. You have a job to give away that money to help the people, help people out in the public, not just to help yourself. And that's the job he's failing at.
Yeah. The other aspect of this is that I am reading more and more about extremely rich people giving money to Donald Trump, which appears to be in return for certain favors that he might be able to grant them should he be reelected as president. Is Elon Musk among them?
Well, what we know that Musk and Trump met recently and that Trump is asking for Musk to give him money. Obviously, Trump is in financial trouble both personally because of all his legal problems, but also politically. The RNC and his campaign are way, way behind this year. So he's looking for basically somebody to come in and save him. And he asked Musk for lots of money. Musk has said he's not going to give to either candidate. We'll see if that holds true. I mean, from my reporting, Musk isn't somebody who often donates to anybody but himself.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing you may be referencing is this investor. There's a guy who, an American, who's heavily invested in TikTok, the
yes.
Chinese social media company. And remember how much Trump hated TikTok,
right.
Tried to ban TikTok, thought it was China's influence operation in the U.S. After this billionaire comes to Trump and says, hey, listen, maybe TikTok isn't so bad. Obviously, with the undertone of maybe I'll give you a lot of money for your campaign, Trump does a complete reversal on TikTok and now says it's great and just stay around. But that gives you a sense of how easy it may be to buy Donald Trump's favor, either now or even when he's in the White House.
Well, I saw that yesterday because, Trump was one of those who's, he's always trying to get back at China. And yet suddenly TikTok he's urging Congress not to pass this bill, which has both Republican and Democratic support, to require TikTok to divorce from its Chinese parent company, ByteDance, or else go dark in the U.S. So you think there may be a connection there. What about, I also heard that he has turned around on Bud Light as well. Can you bring us up to date on that?
Well, I remember Bud Light had this short-lived ad campaign, I think it was last year, where they had a transgender person endorsing Bud Light. All these people freaked out and vowed to not drink Bud Light ever again, and
right.
Their sales went down. So, yes, Trump seems to have turned around on them, too. I mean, this is what people, this is the downside of having a president who is financially needy, as I said, both politically and personally. It could be very, very easy to get him to change his mind on something. And, it's kind of funny when it's Bud Light, but if you think about the many, many things the president has power over, it starts to not be funny anymore.
Okay, so just to be clear, because I want to know what the rules are, it is now okay to buy Bud Light again?
I mean, in my opinion, it was never okay. But, you know, I think in the opinion of Donald Trump, it is good.
Well, you have a different issue with Bud Light. But yeah.
Yeah, I just, I'm a Coors person.
Yeah. Okay, so the other thing that's going on involves the Republican Party. Apparently, I saw this headline from your website yesterday, that there has been a mass firings at Republican National Party headquarters from the people who apparently have been installed at Donald Trump's behest. I'm just curious, what's the status of their, I mean, do they actually now write checks to his legal team? Or what's the setup there?
Well, they already did. They were already paying for his legal defense. They're paying for his lawyers in a lot of these criminal cases that have really nothing to do with the presidency. They've paid for him to sue the New York Times and CNN, these sort of frivolous lawsuits that he's filed and lost. So they were already paying his legal bills. They were already holding events at his property. You know, they were already doing a lot to put money in Donald Trump's pockets or to save him money on legal bills. The question is, you know, what more could they do? And I guess it's something that really surprised me. And the RNC obviously was already pretty well aligned with Trump. It's not like this was a hostile takeover in 2016. Mm-hmm. And in 2024, they still see all these people that need to be purged. I wondered if this could be somehow self-defeating for the Trump folks, if they kick everybody out and put their own people in, and that makes their whole campaign apparatus worse.
So does he just have a claim on the money intended for the presidential campaign, or would this affect any funding for down-ballot candidates as well?
Oh, lots of it. I mean, the RNC is in huge financial trouble now. It's way behind Democrats fundraising, in part because it's been funding all these legal battles for Trump. And yeah, that's not just for the presidency. That's for Senate races, House races. I mean, that's the entire Republican Party that he's turned into kind of his own bank account.
All right. On the Biden side of the ledger now, a congressional committee is going to be questioning the special counsel who investigated Biden's mishandling of those classified records. And this is because of the comment, which basically said, Biden is a kindly old man, bless his little heart, who just can't remember things. I mean, what is likely to come out of this testimony today?
Well, we already know a little bit more. So this morning they released the transcript of that very long, it was a two-day interview with Biden that the special counsel's office did back in October. That was sort of the basis for this charge, that he was an elderly man who couldn't remember things. And I would encourage people to read our story about it, because it's really interesting in detail. But basically, yes, there were instances in which Biden seemed to fumble with dates. But our story says basically that there were other instances in which he corrected the prosecutors about when things happened or what happened. And it did not seem, the implication that the special counsel made was that Biden didn't know where he was a lot of the time or just seemed confused. And that did not seem to be the case. In fact, a lot of the confusion seemed to relate to one very painful episode in his life, the death of his son.
Yeah. Well, the stories on Elon Musk, your story in the New York Times, is a big deal and very interesting reading. So I certainly recommend that to our listeners. We talk to David Farenthold every Tuesday. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News. A first look at the FAA's audit of Boeing's 737 production line paints a pretty ugly picture when it comes to safety and quality control. Chris, what did they find?
Well, the FAA, as you know, has been all over Boeing's Renton plant and the Spirit Air Systems plant in Wichita, which makes the fuselages. Since the door plug blowout in January, as many as 20 folks have been all over that plant in Renton. Well, the New York Times got a quick look at those initial results, and it reports that the FAA found multiple instances where Boeing and Spirit failed to comply with quality control requirements in that production. FAA investigators performed 89 specific audits in the Renton production facility. Boeing failed 33 of them.
Yikes.
And that's basically, in layman's terms, there is a specific way to perform a task. If it isn't done to those specifications, it's considered out of compliance. Spirit failed 7 of the 13 audits at its plants. For example, the New York Times reports a Spirit worker was seen using a hotel key card to check the door seal, like the distance of the door seal. Liquid dish soap that you might use at home was used as a lubricant in another example at Spirit, most likely out of the norm for guidelines for safety and things like that. Now, it didn't detail exactly what 33 of those 33 Boeing failures were, but the FAA then also tested engineers about the quality and safety procedures at the company. 6 of them they talked to, they scored their responses. The average score was 58 out of 100. in terms of knowing what the actual procedures and safety protocols are when it comes to the production systems. And that was just at the Renton plant. So that doesn't sound good.
Has Boeing had a response to this?
Not as of yet, because they said, you know, they're still under FAA investigation. And again, this was just a snapshot. The Times got a look at the PowerPoint that's coming up in that. So that's pretty scathing. We also found out yesterday that another part of the 737 has been under an FAA airworthiness directive since last July, but we're just hearing about it now. Pilots have been reporting an uncontrolled spoiler movement on the wings that resulted in unintended rolling. Spoilers, as you know, are the flaps on the top of the backs of the wings that allow, you know, control, you know, the wing surfaces there. Investigation found that wire bundles controlling those spoilers were installed incorrectly. The bundles were apparently rubbing up against internal structures inside the wing. The directive requires that customers check those bundles and make sure that they make the necessary repairs if necessary. And then one more, this one's getting worldwide attention. A Boeing whistleblower was found dead in a hotel parking lot over the weekend. 62-year-old John Barnett was in the middle of his testimony in his whistleblower case against the company. When he was found, police say Barnett died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. He filed a complaint in 2017 against Boeing and production of the Dreamliner in South Carolina. He claimed that Boeing was cutting corners to get the planes out the door.
Well, clearly, this is not going away anytime soon,
no,
is it?
No, this is not. The chickens are coming home to roost in terms of, you know, what Boeing's management decided to do, you know, decade ago and more than, focusing away from production into more your bottom line and dividends than possible. So, yeah, this is it's not pretty.
Well, if the idea was to help the bottom line, it sure has backfired. I mean, this morning, Boeing stock's down 3.75% at 185. So that's pretty bad.
Yeah, it is.
Right now, we're going to get an update on the chaos currently happening in Haiti, where the prime minister has announced his resignation. I called up CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland.
We can really track this, Dave, back to 2021 with the assassination of President Moïse. At that time, Prime Minister Henry took over the government and has refused to relinquish power or have elections ever since. There was growing demands for that. Social unrest has broken out. Henry, attempted to solicit support from the international community, which translated into Kenya offering up 1,000 police officers. The United States was going to provide $200 million for that particular support mission. And Henry had actually traveled to Kenya to sign this deal. I was then refused entry back into Haiti because of the fact that the gangs had taken over about 80% of the capital, controlled the airport, and then, of course, conditions on the island deteriorated after that. Now we have CARICOM, the Caribbean Organization of States, with the United States involved, as well as Canada, meeting in Jamaica. In the last few hours, it appears that Henry has resigned, and a 7-member presidential commission has been established to rule the country until elections can be held. Whether or not that will quell violence, of course, remains the question of the moment.
So that was a pretty bad decision to leave the country, sounds like.
Obviously a very bad decision, and Prime Minister Henry, I doubt, will ever be able to re-enter Haiti ever again.
Now, is this still fallout from the earthquake? My understanding is that the country really never recovered from that.
In many ways, that's very true. The earthquake back in 2010 contributed to the misery that had been a long portion of, frankly, Haiti's history. During a cholera outbreak in 2010, which was linked to actually some of the peacekeepers that had arrived in the country from Nepal. In addition to that, on top of the destruction by the earthquake, it's estimated that 250,000 people died in Haiti out of a population of only about 11 million. And in many ways, the economy, which was in pretty bad shape to begin with, has never, ever really recovered from that event.
Now, in the past, there has been a movement of refugees from Haiti to the U.S. Has that happened this time?
So far, at least, to the best of my knowledge, we have not seen a massive influx of refugees attempting to make their way to the United States. Obviously, as social conditions deteriorate, that is a distinct possibility. As we look at the situation right now, there are about 1 million people out of 11 million in Haiti, we believe, are on the brink of famine. And there are UN reports that about 350,000 people have basically fled from their homes and are kind of living on the run on the streets or in tents or in rural communities, overcrowded schools, places like that, because of fear of these particular gangs. We've seen a massive destruction of social infrastructure, hospitals being ransacked, gangs stealing everything out of hospitals to include the doors and the windows, making conditions very, very bad in terms of just basic provision of clean water, sanitation, food, and basic health care.
We're hearing from CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland. I think you'll agree his description makes it sound like pretty much a hopeless situation. So I asked him, how does this end?
Yeah, many of them are, I think, agents of various figures in Haiti. One former president, for example, is believed to be backed by several of the gangs. One of the most prominent gang leaders is a guy named Jimmy Barbecue Cerisier, who seems to be in control of one of the largest gangs called G9. And there now seems to be some coordination between the gangs in opposition, of course, to the government that was headed up by Prime Minister Henry. But as social conditions broke down, these gangs actually attacked the presidential palace, broke into prisons, have released over 3,000 prisoners. How they react to this announcement about this formation of a presidential commission and eventual elections will tell the tale, I think, on whether or not this now is moving towards some type of stability or towards continued violence.
Dare I ask how he got the nickname Barbecue?
I'm a little uncertain about that, quite frankly, Dave, how he got the name Barbecue. But he does seem to be the primary gang leader. He made a statement the other day, which I think was interesting of note. He said, quote, "Either Haiti becomes paradise or a hell for all of us."
Okay, well, people who think that we have a terrible choice in our election can probably get some perspective from that.
Perhaps.
CBS military analyst Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Dave.
We're going to talk about trust. So I figured we should bring in a guy whose company has trust in its name, PwC Trust Solutions. His name is Wes Bricker. He's the vice chair. And your group did a survey of businesses this year to find out how much bosses trust their employees. So I'm guessing you were trying to assess the effect of remote work on the trust factor, Wes?
Well, that's right, David. We were looking at trust in a number of different areas that are important to business. This is the fourth year that we've done a survey of 5,000 business leaders, consumers, and employees. And what we found, David, was that business leaders tend to trust their employees more than employees realize. 86% of business leaders would say they trust their employees. Only 67% feel that. And so that's a window of opportunity to narrow it. And that those numbers tend to hold up even if it's remote workers. 7 out of 10 business leaders trust their employees even when they're working remotely. So that gives us a bit of flexibility as we plan going forward, David.
Well, that's good. So in other words, more employers are willing indeed to let their workers continue to work remotely?
Well, they are, but it's important because it's also changing that business leaders see the need for trust with their employees as being connected to the way businesses operate and grow and compete. That's especially important in areas like serving consumers with products and services, delivering higher quality. Productivity of employees, as well as retaining key talent within a workforce. So this issue of trust is important to business, important to bottom lines, and certainly important to the relationship that business leaders have with their employees.
I know a lot of people listen to us who listen to us work from home, and they would like to continue working from home. And so it is in their interest to do whatever it takes to get their bosses to trust that they can do a good job working from home. Do you have any tips on how employees could demonstrate that? For example, I know that some people were telling me that the software actually monitors their mouse movement so the bosses can assess whether somebody is actually, you know, sitting at the desk doing things or just goofing off. So, I mean, should people actually make sure they move the mouse more? I mean, how do you establish trust if you're working from home and you want to keep working from home?
I think it starts with understanding expectations on both sides of that equation, whether it's business leaders being clear about what the strategy is, the culture, the work that needs to get done, and the quality that consumers expect, but also for employees to understand how they fit into the team, how they can build value, and how they can get the training and the focus to remain productive. All of that comes together in the need to, one, acknowledge the importance of trust between businesses and employees, but then, secondly, to have a plan around it, to really have ownership around it, and to reinforce a culture of trust from top to bottom in businesses. So it's not just monitoring in different ways, although perhaps that is a way of doing it. It requires really a culture of trust, and employees should know that their leaders start from a position of trusting rather than distrust.
Okay, well, I guess that's good. So there's no secret sauce here. I mean, because when, for example, when the employer sends out surveys saying, you know, did you meet your goals? What have you done to make your company more productive today? You should probably respond to those.
Well, dialogue is critical, whether it's trying to get a sense of where productivity is, where consumer needs are being met, or whether adjustments are required. It's more than just a survey or monitoring tool. It's part of a broader plan, and we see business leaders needing to, you know, this is really a team sport across business leaders and employees. They need to see themselves as being part of a team.
Wes Bricker is the vice chair of PwC Trust Solutions. Thank you, Wes.
Thank you very much, David. Great to be with you.
CBS Morning's lead national correspondent David Begnaud has the heartwarming story of a dog in Dallas, Texas, whose life was forever changed by a stranger's kindness, illustrating the true essence of being a good neighbor.
Meet Gaia, a husky with a story to tell about how when one life ends, sometimes an even better one begins. In Dallas, Texas, Gaia's life was confined to that tiny backyard. That's because her loyal owner, Sandra, was hospitalized. The next-door neighbor, Lisa Cataract, noticed that the 9-year-old female looked lonely. So she offered to walk her.
I walked in, and then Gaia came up to me very slowly. And then I said, oh, hi. And then what's your name? So I had to look down at her tag and saw it was Gaia.
One walk turned into 3 weeks of walks.
Come down here.
And then one question Lisa was not expecting from Sandra's dear friend, Gilda Levy.
2 weeks before Sandra died, she said, I don't know if you've thought about this, but would you like to take her?
And what did you say?
Sure, I would love to.
So when the time came, Lisa was summoned to Sandra's home right next door. The 80-year-old neighbor she barely knew was gone.
She had just died. So I just clipped her leash on, and then I said, okay, goodbye.
She walked Gaia from Sandra's home into hers. And from that moment on, Gaia's life changed.
Good girl. Good girl.
Lisa wanted to get Gaia out more. And she noticed on walks around the neighborhood that Gaia was so calm around children. So she and Gaia enrolled in and passed a pet therapy program.
I can tell when I put on her vest, she's ready to go.
Their first assignment was Children's Medical Center Dallas.
So
here was an elderly dog who rarely ever left Sandra's home, now finding a home with Lisa and in the hearts of these young children.
Dogs are like the best thing that ever happened to me, like in this hospital.
You're missing some more, Gaia.
Oh, wait, there's more. Lisa thought the piercing blue-eyed beauty would be just right for another kind of therapy, hospice. It just so happened that when Gaia's owner died, Lisa was finishing her training to be an end-of-life doula.
You're pretty good to have around.
Today, she and Gaia minister to the terminally ill.
You are precious.
Good morning.
Wow, what a beautiful dog.
Aw, thank you.
Hi.
Are you doing all this for Gaia or for you?
Oh, that is a good question. I think that that's a good question. Let me think about that. I think I'm doing this for both of us. I think it benefits both of us. She gets to go out and see people, and I get to see the response that she gets when she's out. There's just nothing better than that.
Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. 7:48, and now visiting us from the Gian Ursula Show, which starts at 9 o'clock, here is G. Scott. As you've heard, the lewd conduct law is not being enforced anymore. And already there's been a big change in, shall we say, the Seattle nightlife scene.
Yeah, there is.
And G. Scott is all over this story.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, wait, don't make the listeners think that. Like, I'm all over it.
I'm just saying you've delved into the story, and you are reporting on what you determined as part of your investigation.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, who would have thought that this would play out this way? The place is called Supernova.
Supernova.
And it's not really a strip club, but it's going to be turned into one.
So it has to do with astronomy.
Right, kind of. Yeah, yeah. And I just thought that who would have thought that this would take place, but I think it is about time for that to happen. I've always said that I thought it was really bad that the state of Washington didn't allow that. And here's why. Because basically they're trying to say, as Dave, that people go in and they buy the mandatory two Sprites or two lemonades or whatever the case might be, or two sodas, so for the admission to get in, plus the cost of getting in as well. But what happens is you really can't regulate what's going on, because a lot of people are drinking out in the cars. You don't know what they consume before they go into the strip club. And I think that makes things even more dangerous. I like the way that this is going to be happening here.
Okay, so tell me about this club. What do you know about the club?
Well, I just know that as far as the club is concerned, it's a normal bar place, but it's never a strip club. But for this particular day, I think the March 22nd, 23rd, they're going to turn it into like an establishment, like they're going to have like a beach, like kind of a beach spring club kind of going on. And I'm looking forward to hearing about it. I'm not saying I'm going to be there at all.
Well, I guess I don't understand the sequence of events. So because there's no more lewd law, and you can serve liquor at a strip club now, right? That's the change that happened. They're turning it into a strip club, or it always was a strip club, but didn't serve liquor?
No, it never was a strip club.
It's not a strip club.
No, it never was. It never was a strip club, but I guess on this particular time when they open it up, they will turn it into one then.
I see. So was that the intent of the law, to increase the supply of strip clubs?
No, I think the intent with anything, right? One, I believe that it will increase revenue. Mm-hmm. That's one. I mean, that laws and things like that always helps to increase revenue. But I always talked about it from the standpoint of I think these establishments need to be a lot safer. And I think it is safer when you have someone, if you're in there and it's,
you have someone monitoring the booze.
It's monitoring the booze, as opposed to, hey, let me go back out to my car really quick. I go out to my car. I come back in. I go back out to my car. I come back in. I think that is the case. It's a good thing.
I remember The Lusty Lady, which was across. You remember it too, Chris.
Or right? First
across,
Ave?
Across only because of the wonderful billboards.
I've never
been in there.
It was across from the Seattle Art Museum. Perfect location. And then there was, what was it, Ricks and Lake City?
Ricks and Lake City Way.
Yeah, yep. That was a notorious one, yeah.
Right. And I have not, I haven't heard this phrase strip club in years. So I'm just curious, is this signaling a comeback in the genre?
I think that it will. You're right. Out of all my friends, everybody that I know, nobody goes to strip clubs here in the state of Washington. I'm not even exaggerating right now. Yeah. I'm being very serious. They go in other places. They don't go here in this state. No, I think it's a return to that. I kind of made a funny on social media, and we have been talking about the NBA. returning to Seattle. Mm-hmm. And I said that this was the first sign that really confirms an NBA team is coming back to Seattle because with the regulation of alcohol in the strip club.
I see. That's what was holding it back.
Mm-hmm. You know who James Harden is?
No.
He's the president of the Association of NBA Players.
Uh-huh.
They go, just a joke. He doesn't. But so I just want to make sure this straight. In your entire, I only got 1 minute, adult lifetime, you've never been inside of an establishment.
We went to Tokyo once on a night out.
Okay.
And it turned out, yes, there was pole dancing there.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's pretty much the extent of my
story.
I've been to plays where nudity was involved. There's a play at the Rep about a baseball team where the second act begins with a shower scene, which had an actual shower and six nude men.
Oh, okay.
That's the most nudity I've seen in public in Seattle.
I have a lot more questions, but I'm sure traffic's more important.
I think so. At this particular time, yes, traffic is more important.
Nobody wants to hear me ask Dave Ross these questions.
We can talk later, if you wish. I can educate you on the Seattle theater scene. There seems to be some tension between the King County Sheriff's Office and Burien City officials. In fact, the county sheriff's office has filed a lawsuit in federal court to determine whether Burien's homeless ban is even constitutional. Current News Radio's Sam Campbell joins us live now from outside Burien City Hall. Sam, you have the reaction from Burien's mayor.
Well, that's right, Dave. We actually got this reaction because Jason Rance at our sister station, KTTH, had spoken with Mayor Kevin Schilling yesterday. Now, me, as well as Kate Stone, another reporter at Cairo News Radio, we've reached out to Burien City leaders many times, but to no avail. In fact, I finally got an email response yesterday about some of the questions on this newly passed amended ordinance that they passed last week. Finally got a response from the city's communications person, but that was just directing me to a frequently asked questions page. Now, Mayor Kevin Schilling, we heard in an interview with Rance yesterday, wants to paint this as political partisanship, rather, implying that the sheriff is just picking and choosing which laws to enforce. Here's what he told Rance on our sister station for Conservative Talk, KTTH.
The voters of King County took away their right to elect the sheriff, and I think this is the consequences of seeing that. This is the consequences of prioritizing politics over public safety.
But for the sheriff's office, it's more about the law and legal culpability, as in the sheriff doesn't want her deputies in trouble if they're enforcing an ordinance that's ultimately determined to be unconstitutional somewhere down the line. You know, some of the problems that the sheriff has brought up that she has with this newly amended ordinance is this map that was attached to the ordinance last week. I think you remember we spoke about it. It implemented these 500-foot so-called buffer zones around libraries, parks, daycares, and schools in the city. And if you looked at the map that was attached to the ordinance, that encompasses a majority of the land within the city. And what's more is small text at the bottom of that map said that the city manager had discretion to change the map at any time without, you know, the typical council approval to protect the public health and safety. So, and what's more is the sheriff insists that, you know, this was all her and that King County Executive Dal Constantine had little to do with it. Here's Sheriff Patty Cole Tindall at the press conference she held yesterday.
This is 100% my decision. The executive gives me full authority for the operational considerations for the King County Sheriff's Office, and I made this decision.
Now, Schilling is also implying that the sheriff's office is picking and choosing which city's anti-camping ordinances to enforce, because, as you know, Burien is not the only city around King County that outsources its police services to the sheriff's office. But Schilling is saying that the sheriff's enforcing the ordinances in places like SeaTac.
There are communities directly next to us who have the exact same ordinance, and they're able to enforce their ordinance.
And so I was curious about that, so I checked out SeaTac's anti-camping ordinance, and there are some key differences. You know, it's not exactly accurate to say that it's exactly the same ordinance as what was passed in Burien. SeaTac's ordinance, for example, has an enforcement provision within it where it says that the enforcement will only happen within 1,000 feet of Highway 99, as well as at any park. within the city. So it's a little bit different. There are some key distinctions in other places in the ordinance, but it is not the exact same ordinance. And I think that the sheriff's office is taking issue also with the fact that Burien's newly amended camping or anti-camping ordinance was passed and made effective immediately after it was voted on last Monday.
The big issue seems to be the map. Is there the feeling among some people that the buffer zone was chosen for the express purpose of basically eliminating any sites for camping?
So that depends on who you ask. Number one, if you ask the city will say that this is to protect public safety. And they have a lot of, whereas clauses in their ordinance that cite things about public safety. Mainly, they're citing accusations without attached police reports of crime coming from homeless encampments. But if you ask some of the people like this encampment that I'm looking at right across from City Hall, if you ask them what they think about it, they think that this is an indirect way to shove them out of the city entirely because they had the original camping ordinance, which was Ordinance 818. That got amended to Ordinance 827. That was back in the fall. And since then, it has seemingly expanded where people can and cannot camp. Mm-hmm. And so the people here in this camp that I'm looking at, I just spoke with them yesterday. I plan on speaking with them again today. They told me, look, we haven't been given many offers of shelter at all. And meanwhile, they're just trying to find a place to stay. In fact, many of them actually came from that home church that was behind, or the tent village that was behind the home church here in Burien. And when that shut down, they had to find somewhere else to stay. And so they came downtown here to downtown Burien, where I'm told the sidewalks were wide enough that they could set up a tent while people could still walk.
Well, can you remind us why did the church shut down? Because that seemed to be working out.
Right. There was a back and forth between the city and the church about, the fact that the city was claiming the church didn't have permission to basically set up a tent village behind the church, saying that it was violating basically zoning laws. But the church was maintaining its position. And ultimately, it was only meant as a temporary stopgap in place to find some people shelter so that they wouldn't be in violation of the original anti-camping ordinance that passed and went into effect in November. And so this was to try and get them off the street. In the meantime, while the city determined what they were going to do with that $1 million offer and 35 pallet shelter beds from the county. Now, as far as I know, the city has still not determined a place of where that help from the county will be set up so that they can put those pallet shelters up. I still don't know, if they have chosen a location. What I do know is driving around Burien, I haven't seen it.
Well, then it sounds like this latest camping crisis is a symptom of the city failing to fulfill its obligation to find an alternative shelter, which I think most cities have to do, don't they?
Most cities, when they do enact these anti-camping ordinances, they have to abide by a court case, Martin versus Boise, that stipulates that if you are going to outlaw camping, then you can't do it at all places at all times, and you have to consider whether or not a shelter is available. And if no shelter space is available, then you can't enforce it. That's what that court case determines. And so that's also one of the concerns that the sheriff's office and some of the critics here of this Burien anti-camping ordinance have.
Car News Radio, Sam Campbell. Thank you, Sam.
Thanks, Dave.
Now let's talk nightlife. Seattle Nightclub is planning to introduce nude dancing after the state law against lewd conduct was rolled back last month. Let's go live to Car News Radio's Kate Stone to tell us about this. So is this ushering in a new phase of Seattle nightlife, Kate?
Yeah, Dave, we're talking booze and bearskin set to mix together at nightclubs, bars, and strip clubs in Washington. Now, to be clear, this isn't a requirement, but state lawmakers recently passed a bill, and it is headed to the governor's desk, so it's not quite law just yet, but it does allow scantily clad patrons and employees, or at least more scantily clad than they have been before. And I actually talked to the owner of the Supernova nightclub in downtown Seattle. He says he's planning to be the first in Washington, he believes, to have fully nude dancers. Now, he already has his liquor license, but strip clubs, which are 18 and over establishments, they would need to actually apply for a liquor license before they could serve alcohol alongside their fully nude dancers. Nightclubs don't exactly have that problem because they already have a liquor license. This all came about because there were bars in Capitol Hill that were raided by Seattle police because of a lewd conduct law that was on the books. Those bars pushed back, saying that this was persecution, and there was a long-standing tension between law enforcement and traditionally LGBTQ plus clubs. And the state liquor and cannabis board actually rolled back the lewd conduct law. They decided to stop enforcing it because of this pushback, and the governor actually supported it, and state lawmakers went to the table and wrote out a bill that essentially codified this. And the entire reason for it was the Capitol Hill bar said, we didn't even have nude dancers. We didn't even have nude patrons. Our bartender, a male bartender, was simply showing a nipple during his service of alcohol to our patrons. And that's much too strict. So Washington will now be the latest to join a whole host of other places, including Las Vegas, Miami, in allowing these naked dancers. However, I did talk to Zach Levine, and he said, you know, it's not necessarily going to be, he's turning the establishment into a strip club. He says there's not going to be triple X's on the door or anything like that. And they are hiring extra security. There will be rules. You can't touch the performers. So there are some standards that are still being put in place, at least for his nightclub. And he expects others will follow suit.
Okay, so it'll be a high-class place. So
that's what he says.
Okay, so based on the... So because of the male nipple, we're now to basically Las Vegas rules? Is that what this is, really?
I mean, it's not exactly... There's still a lot to figure out. Again, the strip clubs essentially have to apply for liquor licenses, and Levine said he wouldn't be surprised if there's a lot of scrutiny, maybe even some pushback about that. The question is, will strip clubs be able to have anyone who's 18 and they simply have to have a barrier between those who are 18 and over and those who are 21 and over? There's still kind of a lot to figure out since they have simply stopped enforcing this rule, but, you know, it remains to be seen, essentially. And if, you know, what Zach Levine said is correct for other nightclub and bar owners, it'll be up to the patrons to decide if having fully nude performers there is something they would like. Zach Levine said, I'd be happy to give anyone a refund. And again, this is not turning into what he called a seedy strip club. He simply said that this is something that's already enjoyed in places like Portland and Vancouver, and he simply wants Washington to join in a change he says is long overdue.
Well, we wouldn't want anything seedy in Seattle, because that would lead to, you know, graffiti and stuff like that. So there are ways then to make sure that there's not too much drinking that goes on, such that there would be a danger to either dancers or employees.
Yeah, the law very clearly states that if you are going to serve alcohol and have fully nude performers or employees or patrons of any kind, you have to be a 21 plus establishment. Mm-hmm. So again, that remains to be seen if they'll make any exceptions. For example, if they have an entire wall erected in the building between the 18 plus and the 21 plus, all that still remains to be figured out. But the law pretty clearly states if you want to have the booze, you have to have a liquor license and you have to up your age requirements.
I'm not so much sure what goes on inside the club. Typically, as I understand it, most of the problem happens outside the club in the parking lot as the patrons, as the intoxicated patrons leave. And small tiffs become big tiffs.
Well, I mean, that'll be a problem for law enforcement, but it seems like that is already a problem, you know, whether or not the performers or anyone else is scantily clad. But yeah, it's a whole new world of opportunity, shall we say, for not just the nightclubs, but the patrons as well. And, you know, Supernova Seattle is expecting a bit of profit jump because Zach Levine says that this is an area that of adult entertainment that people have been looking for, and he's excited to provide it.
Okay. Well, it's always good to hear the phrase scantily clad make a comeback. It's been just too long. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.